Good morning. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. We'd like to do Senate Bill 582 first, but we need one more member. So let's do Senate Bill 98 first and do a public hearing on that, and then if we get another member, we'll do a work session on Senate Bill 582, and that will probably be the 90th work session that Senate Bill 582 has had. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 98. Good morning, Mazin. Good
morning, Mr. Chair. Senator George.
Good morning.
That probably will be 89, not 90th work session.
It feels like, I think we got it, though. I think our university folks are now telling us we found the promised land on 582.
Okay, well, Senate Bill 98, Mr. Chair, provides a structure and concept for that deals in forest lands, as well as it tries to use those primarily forest lands to be newly acquired by the Oregon forester and build a fund, a higher education fund for a structure of a scholarship that goes to 90% of the revenues coming from the revenues on selling of the timber of the forests to this education fund or higher education fund. This is for only higher education. And the 10% goes to counties from where those forests reside. And also it builds a system of how you sell the bonds, where the revenue bonds go, and then the different accounts and funds where you have reserves and payments and administration coming from. And you'd find all these things going into different details that probably does not have any specific amounts or specific parcels of forests, if you will, that to be included in this process. And as you would see in section 12 of the page 8, the amounts that are for the bonding program to be out of this bill is still a blank and it's not clear, but the structure it's trying to build is quite interesting. However, we also know of a dash 2 and a dash 3 amendments to the bill, and I think they have probably a different way of looking at things. The dash 2 and dash 3, they both almost revise all the bill. As you'd see, both of them on page 2 delete line 4 to 45 and pages 3 through 8, which means most of the bill will be revised with both the amendments. And they try to establish a different way of looking at it. However, the dash 3 seems to either be missing a few sections, because you'd see you're missing some of the of the pages on the dash 3 somehow. Things didn't work out in the copying as well as they should, because we're missing sections.
Does it portend well for the dash 3?
So
who drafted the dash 3s to Dave Moskowitz? And the dash 2s?
Department of Forestry.
Okay, let's do the bill itself first. So who's the sponsor of Senate Bill 98? Is it the department? Okay, why don't we have you guys come up? But you know what I'm going to do before we do that? I'm going to do a work session on Senate Bill 582, and then we'll come right back to the department.
Sorry, I'm late. Mayor in my office.
releases.
So, I can just close the public hearing, correct?
Oh, okay. What are we doing with those? 582?
Yeah. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 98, open a work session on Senate Bill 582. Senator Morse. And, Rich, do you want to come up and...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, for the record, Frank Morse, representing the Senate, District 8, Albany and Corvallis. What we discovered, Mr. Chair, was at the last minute when we were literally taking the bill to the floor of the Senate, that there was a very, very key three words essentially left, or actually, yeah, left out of the bill. And the bill as it was written substantially changed how those royalties would be paid and distributed, and it created a huge problem for the university. So on page 2, subsection 6, line 26, the amendment is to insert, quote, 20% of after of, so that it reads, cause the transfer of 20% of the income realized. The language in the amended bill that we're now looking at would imply 100%, and that just is practically and physically impossible, and Mr. Litton can address why that's the case.
Great. Questions for Senator Morse? And just, I'm not, folks, recall the good, just don't want to get folks out of context here. We've been at this for 3 years trying to perfect this bill. So for me, it's, but we're just jumping right into the fray. So, Rich Linton.
Good morning. Rich Linton. I'm Vice President for Research at the University of Oregon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, pleasure to be here. And I think we're on the final feet of the long race that we've had to get this bill finished. And in the last amendment, the evergreen provisions were inserted. That is, as we begin to pay back the state for the tax credits that were issued, additional credits would be authorized for the institutions, which is a fantastic step, and I appreciate Senator Morse and others helping put that provision in. Unfortunately, when it was put in, it deleted language about the payback to the state being 20% of the revenues generated, licensing revenues, royalties, et cetera, rather than, as it would read, 100% of those being paid back. That creates, or would have created, some major issues for the university. Particularly all along, we've tried to make sure that there were no disincentives for inventors to participate. And if the dash 4 language had stood as proposed, then it would be possible that inventors would in fact never receive, or at least unpredictably long period under which they would not have received any royalty return. And we certainly didn't want that to proceed and discourage inventors from actually using the fund. So the language goes back to the original 20%. That level is such that we can utilize the institutional share of the income rather than penalizing the inventors or the units that supported the work at the university. So it's a very critical change precipitated by the amendment related to the evergreen provision, and we're very excited about the opportunity finally to get this through the Senate.
So now this has made the rounds at the universities, the foundations.
I know, Mr. Chair, I know it's unprecedented, but if you had a form that I could sign in blood that said this is it, I will sign it.
Surprisingly, we have that form.
Oh, you do.
Great. Questions for Senator Moore, sir?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Moore.
So this is like the last leg of the 4x400? You're done.
Yeah,
right.
The race to get the bill done is finished.
We know who ran the sports page this morning.
To raise the money. That's going to be exciting.
And read the article.
As an old track and field guy myself, I was very pleased with what happened yesterday.
Pac-10 champions. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you. Okay, so we have dash six, very simple, A6, Senator George.
I'll move the dash A6 to Senate Bill 582.
Senator George has moved the dash A6 to Senate Bill 582. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. And Senator Morris, if you want to sign that document, it's over with. It's over with staff. Senator George.
And be prepared to carry, right? And move Senate Bill 582 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 582 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Senator George.
Senator George.
Senator George,
good catch, has moved Senate Bill 582 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. Senator Morris will carry the bill. Senator Johnson, you're here for...
Mr. Chair, I'm here for 929.
929. Okay, we'll do... If it's okay with the forestry and folks here for 98, we'll do 929 and then jump back to Senate Bill 98. Keeping our LRO staff on their toes this morning as we jump around on bills. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 929. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 929 creates a credit against personal and corporate income and excise taxes for donations of interest in real property to public or private conservation agencies for specified conservation purposes. The credit is equal to 50% of the loss in value, up to $250,000 for individual or $500,000 per corporation. If the property is in a high priority area, the credit is 75%, up to $400,000 per individual or $750,000 per corporation. The credit first applies in tax years beginning in 2007 and has a 19-year carry forward. The bill also creates a subtraction from personal and corporate taxes for costs incurred in undertaking voluntary habitat conservation actions designed to achieve conservation purposes on forest land or exclusive farm use zone farmland owned by the taxpayer. And the subtraction first applies to tax years beginning in 2008. And you also have in your folder a draft revenue impact that is largely based on the experience of other states, primarily in California and North Carolina. And the impact in 07-09 is $14 million, and in 09-11, the draft estimate is $24.6 million.
So a pretty substantial, this is just a draft revenue impact, but a pretty sizable.
It is a first cut at trying to get a handle on what the universe is. The credits are fairly successful, if that's the right term, in North Carolina and California, and the experience of other states has been the use of the credits has been fairly sizable.
Yeah. Questions for Chris on the revenue impact, draft revenue impact statement. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, may I come forward with others?
You may. Y'all won't have to sign anything in blood, just if you're...
But we're prepared.
It's not the role of this committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. This bill is pretty straightforward. The genesis of it really was in a series of conversations with the Nature Conservancy, and my observation in watching people my age inheriting family tracts of property. If it is the goal of the state of Oregon to try to allow property, whether it's farmland or forest land, to pass intergenerationally without cutting it up to have to pay the taxes on it, we were struggling to try to find a mechanism to do that. I'm aware of people who own timberland over in Central Oregon. The trees are priceless to them standing up. But as they inherit the property, they find themselves in the untenable position of having to cut down the trees in order to satisfy the tax burden. And so in conversations with Nan and Liz Tilbury, who is on the board of the Nature Conservancy, we brought forward this bill in concert with others with the primary purpose of being a mechanism to allow property and farmland to pass in blocks. This was the first time that I had heard the potential revenue impact, which is substantial. I think that's probably the good news and the bad news. The bad news is it costs money. The good news is that there are ample subscribers who are interested in trying to provide this kind of conservation stewardship and pass tracts of property for all the inherent habitat values. And so with that, I think Nan and Ms. Tilbury may have prepared testimony, but I came as one of the chief sponsors on the bill simply to ask the committee to favorably consider Senate Bill 929.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Are you going to stay? Are you?
I'm perfectly happy to stay.
Because I know I have one question, but if you need to. Okay, yes, ma'am. Whoever was going to lead.
Chair Deckard, I'm Nan Evans. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon chapter of the Nature Conservancy. Your staff has already characterized the bill. I'll be brief and say I think the important thing about the bill is it provides another tool, a tool for private landowners to keep their working lands working. It provides essentially a financial incentive to allow lands to stay as working farms or working ranches or working timberlands. It also provides a mechanism that a landowner can use if they choose to continue conservation on their land. It's entirely voluntary. Be willing buyers, willing sellers. It, in a way, provides not only an additional tool, but an additional tool with some economic value, particularly in these times where, as Senator Johnson indicated, the various pressures on landowners to either divide their land or sell their land for economic reasons. This provides another economic choice to a landowner. We also have not seen the fiscal or the revenue impact and would be very interested in looking closely at that. Currently in Oregon, there are about 91 conservation easements owned by a whole range of nonprofit groups. There's another bunch that are owned by the state, and I don't happen to have that number. Currently, there's something over 30,000 acres in conservation easement. The fiscal impact in other states is widely varied. I was a little surprised at the number and would love to look at the assumptions and talk further with your staff about that. And I guess with that, I'd like to turn to Liz Tilbury, who is a member of the Conservancy Board and has some personal experiences she'd like to share with you.
Thank you.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, my name is Liz Tilbury, and I live in Portland. I'm in the investment real estate business. But we have a family ranch in Douglas County in Oakland, and it's a century ranch. It's a working ranch. It's almost 150 years old at this point. And it's actually owned by my mother. It's passed down to the generations that way. And we have had cattle for many years, and the timber operation is a major part of it. The reason that I would hope that you would pass this bill is situations such as ours, where we want to be able to keep in the family, and there's so many pressures to subdivide it. The price of timber is such that, you know, clear cutting the timber is certainly not an option that we want to do. But, you know, I think to encourage people to do what they'd like to do and do, you know, continue the operation as it is, that this kind of thing is very important to landowners.
Good. Yeah, well, thank you for coming and testifying. Questions for this panel? So, and Senator Johnson, you may be the best one to answer this. We've outlined or identified about $10 million in the budget for tax credits. And one thing, Nan, is if you do work with our LRO staff or Senator Johnson, if there are ways, there are probably 40 or 50 competing ideas to make that tax credit list, and this seems like a very obvious good candidate and to try to compete for what is going to be about four or five, maybe six tax credits. We enact new ones this session. If there's ways to cap the revenue impact or allow maybe one or two projects, and that at least I think would make it much more competitive. And I don't know what that does to the value of being for the Nature Conservancy or other organizations to have this out on the street to talk to potential landowners. But I can tell you just on the budget side that I think that'd be helpful.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I'd be willing to do in working with Nan and your professional staff is to try to figure that out. It is always my observation that this building tends to want to hit a home run at every at-bat. And if there is an opportunity to look at a pilot project or a capped project, and if it's fully subscribed very quickly, come back in another session. The finances of another session will be different. But if we can get the concept enshrined in statute, I would be more than happy to limit the subscription, and we come back and take another bite at the apple again once we've proved its efficacy and it's demonstrated to be a very successful project.
And do you have projects that come to mind right away of, well, if we did have this tax credit, we do think there is a project or two out there that would be a good model for showing future legislatures why you might want to do this, why North Carolina did it, why California did it.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, I know that there are a number of discussions going on right now. Liz Tilbury mentioned one on her ranch. I don't want to, that I believe would be a conflict of interest. By the way, she's not having discussions with Conservancy. It's with another nonprofit. But there certainly are a number of cases that people are looking at right now. We also could look at the idea of a cap. A number of states have passed tax credits where they essentially cap it, and it's an open door until you reach the impact level that the cap is at as a way of testing it, and it's something we'd be more than happy to talk with your staff about it. That's if you're interested in pursuing that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
In terms of the quality of the projects and the goal of the program, would you prefer a cap approach or would you prefer a pilot approach?
Senator Decker and Senator Burdick, that's a really good question, and I think I would probably want to go back and talk more broadly with people who have experience in other states to weigh the reasons. I don't think I can really answer that question.
I might just add to the discussion, however, we don't have a whole lot of time. And what I'm hopeful that the committee would do, given that this is one of the committees that's going to stay open, is to set a pretty tight timeline on Ms. Evans' ability to work both with your professional staff to review the underlying assumptions, as well as to have consultation externally with the question that Senator Burdick posed, and get back to the committee. My goal today is, if there are questions, to figure out a mechanism so that we can quickly satisfy the committee's concerns and keep the bill alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think Senator Torres, yes.
Oh, go ahead. Nan, question for you. We have Senate Bill 98 up here in just a few minutes, and it looks like these two are a marriage made in heaven. Because I'm concerned about what I'm seeing on the east side, and that is the very fact that we have properties that are changing from industrial or production properties to recreational properties. They're not being maintained. The fire hazard is unbelievable. And, of course, we've had a couple of fires that have originated on those because of a lightning strike. Tremendous amount of energy generated as the fire sweeps towards the mountains and burns up timber. And I think the potential is just unlimited. And along with the idea that I'd love to meld in my bill, which was authorized the Department of Forestry to begin to negotiate with the federal government for actually acquiring back the forests that belong to the state of Oregon and put them into a system of management very similar to this, because that's too big of a resource to allow to be lost. Had you guys been looking at 98 as a possibility of integrating the two bills together?
Chair Deckard, Senator George, we hadn't looked at the possibility of integration because this bill, 929, applies to private lands as opposed to public lands. It would be essentially the choices of the private landowner to continue ranching or forestry or logging practices as they are doing now. So it's
okay.
we might look at that, as I said, but the land ownership has made us think of it, think of those two things differently.
Okay. Great. Other questions for? So it is up to the proponents, but that would be my best counsel to you, is if you, I guess you have two or three routes. The revenue impact statement, and it's a draft, so it's just that, a draft. Would the number's just too high for us to, but if there are a way to shape it, if you're interested in it this session and wanted the best chance to compete with the 60 that are trying to make that list of six, I would, my best counsel would be to work on some sort of a pilot project or some sort of really diminishing that revenue impact. And what would really make it a home run, sorry, Senator Johnson, is if you found any incentive that is in that same area that folks would be willing to offset in the land conservation side that are in that general topic area, and then you're well on your way. If you could find any incentive on the books, and our staff also can easily identify those for you, of and then you would offset whatever revenue impact you're creating, and whenever folks do that, then you're really talking, because it's really no revenue impact or little revenue impact.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We appreciate the opportunity to keep the bill alive, and we'll get with your professional staff and get back with you.
Thanks. Thank you for coming to the
Thank
Capitol.
You.
We have one more panel on this bill. Oh, well, actually, we just have Stephen Kafori, not just. We have Stephen Kafori. I saw a number of names with you, Stephen. That was Ms. Evans and Ms. Tilbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm actually representing two clients here this morning. The Wildlife Society, which is a professional society of wildlife biologists, is supportive of these kinds of conservation measures. Obviously, a working forest is a much better habitat for wildlife than a lot of residential subdivisions, and so we're supportive of the bill. I wanted to also talk to you a little bit about my other client, Trust for Public Land. Trust for Public Land is a national organization similar to the Nature Conservancy, except that there is one major difference in that is differentiated from Nature Conservancy. Well, the two differences. One is that we do not own property. The Nature Conservancy often buys property and holds it. We act as a broker, and Senator Decker is very familiar with this because we've done a major project in his district, and we're working with Senator George now on something in his district, where we act as the middleman to find property that is in transition or could be in transition with a willing seller. And then we spend a lot of time and effort on doing the mechanics, getting the appraisals, getting surveys, getting whatever environmental impacts may be necessary, historical impacts if it's potentially an area where there had been some Native Americans living. And then do the paperwork to transition this property to a public owner. And we work then with often a coalition of public owners to jointly purchase land and then keep it in public ownership. We have, in the state of Oregon, protected over 78,000 acres of land in this area. As you can see on the inside of this brochure, one of our five focus areas is that of working lands. And we're working with something an area in Senator George's district right now to preserve a 1,400-acre forest. It's a working forest now. We want to keep it a working forest. And so we're already working on this kind of issue. We're very much in favor of this bill, which could help us. Ballot Measure 37, to some extent, has changed the landscape in the state of Oregon in that we cannot rely, as we have in the past, as much on land use planning to protect property. We're going to have to get involved. The citizens of Oregon have told us to, and we have an obligation, I think, to get involved in compensation, and this is one means of compensation rather than waiver of helping the state say it's important to us to preserve this land, and so we're willing to pay for it. One thing I think is especially important, there are some areas in the state where development has not caught up yet but will catch up sometime, there can often be a very small difference between the value of a piece of property in the working land and the value of property for sale. And so when that's the case, a conservation easement is tough to do because there isn't that differentiation that a landowner can get the conservation value back, keep the land working, and get some money back in his pocket. This bill would allow that to happen. It would allow conservation easements to be workable in a lot of areas where, frankly, they are not now. And I think with a relatively small amount of money per owner, you wouldn't have to do a 50% of the value of the land. You could do a much lesser dollar figure and allow a person to remain on the land and to continue that land as working land. We would like to also be involved in this bill. We think the concept is significant. We've done this in a number of other states across the country. We have a lot of technical expertise on how to make this work right, and we would like to work to make this bill something the state of Oregon could expand in the future.
Thank you. Senator George.
I do want to point out that in the brochure it says that Oregon has been losing approximately 35,000 acres of agricultural land each year to development prior to Measure 37.
Quick reading. How did you read that so fast?
I don't know how to read, but I scan really fast.
Other questions or comments? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That is all I had on Senate Bill 582, 929. Anyone else? Close public hearing on Senate Bill 929 and go back to Senate Bill 98. And there, yes, so Department of Forestry and Mr. Paul. And Bill, do you want to come up with, since I think you've been pretty involved with this bill, we'll have this panel introduce us to Senate Bill 98 and the Dash 3s.
Good morning, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. I'm Jim Paul, Forest Management Division Chief with the Oregon Department of Forestry. And my understanding is you'd like to hear first about the original bill. I do have some written comments that are focused primarily on the Dash 2 amendments that we have introduced. I can sort of do both at the same time.
Yeah, if you could just blend them together,
great.
Kind of the department's point of view on this.
Sure. Senate Bill 98 is introduced at the request of the governor by the Department of Forestry. The original bill, some key pieces of the original bill that remain in the Dash 2 amendments are there are really two primary objectives of this bill. The first is to establish a new and dedicated long-term funding source for higher education in Oregon. And the second piece of this bill goal is to provide the state forester with a new tool to address a real growing concern in Oregon around the maintenance of working forests and forest lands that you've heard some about in the discussions in the previous bill, and to address this issue of fragmentation and development of Oregon's forests. The bill had been introduced this session, and sort of the 11th hour in working with the Treasury, we recognized there were some fatal flaws in the funding mechanism that was described in the original bill. So we revamped the bill primarily to address that issue, but in doing that in the Dash 2s, we also sort of beefed up the policy statements right up front of the bill to provide a better context, a more thorough context of the intent of this bill. And the issues surrounding what we're trying to address. Excuse me. I just wanted to say a little bit about the issue of the fragmentation and development piece. This is really an issue that, as a department, we are sort of coalescing around and looking to as the next biggest challenge as we go into the future in Oregon in terms of maintaining forest lands, keeping forest lands in forest lands. It's estimated that about 1 million acres of Oregon's forests, about 10% of our non-federal forest land base, will be converted to development within the next century. There are another 2.5 million acres that exist within a mile of residential or urban areas that are also at risk of conversion to non-forest uses. There's a national context here as well. Nationwide, between 1982 and 1997, the amount of deforestation that occurred in the United States, so that's forests being converted, was equal to the size of all the forests in the state of Washington. And it's estimated that about 1 million acres of private forest lands nationwide will continue to be converted on an annual basis, looking out the next 40 or 50 years. Also, we know that the North Pacific Northwest population is growing faster than the national average currently, so we are set up to actually see a disproportionate share of this forest land conversion to the extent that it's directly associated with population growth. Some of the reasons behind this phenomenon, why it's becoming a growing concern, really escalating, I think, to a tipping point right now as we're looking at this as a department. We're seeing some real changes in economic and ownership patterns that have put a lot of working forests at risk. It's a result of a number of compounding factors, including the one that you've heard about already, the conversion of forest lands to non-forest uses. But another one, and just as important, are reductions in the productive capacity of our private forests currently. In eastern Oregon, this is happening in large, greater degree than western Oregon, you could argue. We're seeing unsustainable harvest levels on some ownerships just to service the debt because of the turnover of forest lands that's occurred in recent years. We've also seen an increase in purchase by landowners with interests other than maintaining a working forest, such as hobby farms or development. Ballot Measure 37 hasn't helped, of course, but Ballot Measure 37 really is just a symptom, isn't really the cause and driver of what we're seeing, the dynamics that are changing. It is important to point out that we do view this bill as a tool of last resort. So the preference is to see working forests remain in private ownership and managed by private landowners. However, this bill, we would look to lands where there is no private buyer interested in continuing to manage those lands in the long-term interest for forest management, and those are the type of ownerships or land parcels that we would apply this authority to look at purchasing and managing. Ultimately, this is a tool to help us achieve, as a department on the Board of Forestry, the overall policy goal of maintaining sustainable forests for Oregon. There are some specific points of this policy that are recognized in the bill in the Dash 2 amendment, starting on the bottom of page 1. I won't go through those, but those are pretty critical to the sort of the context around this bill and what's driving we see this as an important tool. In terms of the financing piece, I talk a little bit about that, given that we had to revamp that, as I said, at the last, essentially the last minute. We are essentially have talked with Treasury in close cooperation with the Governor's Office and a number of our sister agencies that are now named in the Dash 2 amendments, where we are looking at existing funding authorities that are already established, where the purposes of this bill and the types of ownership and the management that would be conducted on these lands is consistent with the funding authorities of agencies with such as the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Parks and Recreation, Community and Economic Development, Department of State Lands, as well as the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Preference would be given to acquiring a management interest in private lands, including community forest lands. However, there are four primary priorities for acquisition that are listed in the bill. One of them is federal ownership that may be important to sustaining forest sector infrastructure within a timber shed. So how this links to maintaining private working forests is that we have some communities, rural communities, a large part in eastern Oregon, where arguably without some portion of the federal forest lands coming back into a working forest mode, those private forest lands may not be viable. They may have to basically, for example, take their timber too far to make it even worthwhile to manage, and it may put increasing pressure of conversion on those lands. The other...
There was a comment made by the department about that bill that I have that said that, you know, if that was the will of the legislature, that the department would negotiate with the feds on possible take back and management of some of these forests. Have you guys actually had those kind of discussions? Because we hear that some of the folks within federal forests are saying, you know what, we're not doing a very good job. Our hands are tighter than yours. Maybe it might be a good idea. Is there any discussion along that line that's occurring between our department and the federal department?
I would Chair Deckert, members of the committee. I would say the context of the discussions, if you could call them, going on right now are not really direct sort of any negotiation type of discussions, but we have the Board of Forestry has convened a committee called the Federal Forest Advisory Committee at the direction of the governor, which is a fairly large committee with a number of interests represented, including the federal forest landowners. It's really an effort just to, I think, flesh out the issues of federal forest lands and the role of federal forest lands in Oregon, and just to start talking about the future and to try and get some consensus or some vision around how the future for federal forests in combination with the other ownerships. That committee still has quite a bit of work to do. I'm not as familiar with where they're at right now. However, I could get some information to you on that if you'd be interested. But that's about the extent of any quote-unquote negotiations, I guess you could say.
Mr. Chairman, this is a question that's couched in a statement. When you look at the way the tribal, particularly on the east side, tribal managements, and when you look at the way the state is running, you know, forests that we have in the privates, and you contrast that with the federal government, you can be flying in an airplane at 300 miles an hour and you can spot the federal forest. My point is, the tribes are involved. Is there other discussions for more transfers to their management? Because I don't care who does it. I just want this thing managed in a better way is my point. Mm-hmm. And so do you know if the tribes are the tribes part of the group that the governor has established? I'm sure they are.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, they may be. I can't recall right now if they are or not.
Okay, I'll let you feel for the bill. Thanks.
All right.
But if you could get me that information, I'd appreciate it.
I'd be happy to. Of course, the federal ownership piece ultimately is limited to the extent that federal laws and willingness. So that is not a key piece of this bill and a key piece of the forest land base that we would look at to using this tool. The other three priorities listed there are, I would say, the more key areas we would look at. They include parcels that or residential development that are important to sustaining the sector infrastructure, lands that are at risk of parcelization for residential development that are important within a timber shed for maintaining the infrastructure. Parcels that are capable with some rehabilitation, you could say, are increased timber production by restoring stocking and improving age class or species distribution. And then finally, at-risk lands that are at risk of parcelization that have some important wildlife habitat values, such as winter range and our community drinking water supplies are associated with those forest lands. Just to close, I guess I would say again, we do believe this could be an important tool for starting to address the issues of making higher education affordable to Oregonians, to maintain working forests, and to support rural community stability. It would give the state forester the means to look at those acquisitions that are viable investments and have the ability to add revenue to the higher education fund while furthering the overall policy of sustainable forests for Oregon. I thank you for your time and consideration. Be pleased to answer any other questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Paul. Do we have any sense of what type of revenue or amounts this might generate? And I know this is long-term, not short-term.
Sure. Chair Deckert, members of the committee, we... I think it's fair to say that primarily or initially we would probably look to the Eastern Oregon use this tool, and the model we're most likely to apply would be what we're currently doing with the Sun Pass Forest down near Klamath Falls, 20,000 some plus acres that we manage. Those lands in large part were purchased in a state where they did need some rehabilitation. It was, I believe, a number of decades before really net revenues were able to be derived off of those. However, currently that forest nets, I believe, $2 to $3 million a year on those acres and is done in a sustainable long-term way. I think that's the type of, sort of our closest guess as to the type of management and the type of net revenues we could expect to derive this tool.
So it would be how many SunPass type projects that the department has available to itself would determine the
yes.
amount of revenue.
Yes. Yes, Chair Deckert, members of the committee, it would of course also depend on in terms of existing funding authorities and partnering with other agencies and entities. To the extent that we could have access to the funding, that would also depend on how much land we would be able to purchase and manage.
Great.
In the original bill, I'd like to ask that. In the original bill, I think that the mechanism, the funding mechanism, was to bond against what would be bought land, and then the revenue coming out of timber would pay for the bonds and pay for the additional scholarship funds. Absent from, I think, the dash two is the funding mechanism that follows any of that, the bonding process. So there is no bonding and no payment for that through the bonding. Is it through another process? That's not clear to me.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, if I understand your question right, essentially the original mechanism described in the original bill is completely removed.
Right.
Any bonding mechanism we may use would have to be one that's available through the economic development or OEB, for example, lottery dollars, and it would be bound by the conditions of the existing mechanism that might be available.
So it's not a self-generating program or sustaining program anymore. It pulls through the economic development fund process.
The concept is that it is self-supporting in the long term. Yes. Okay. Yes.
The revenue from the timber sales would back the bonds.
Correct. Correct. Well,
not pay the bonds.
Would pay the bonds. Correct.
Pay the bonds. Not that. Good point. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, you may not be able to answer this question, and maybe unacceptable in middle office. Was that a decision, an executive decision not to move forward with that original funding mechanism? Because to me it seemed like a great idea.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, we thought it was a great idea, too. Of course, we weren't bonding experts, and when we asked Treasury to review the bill, the feedback we received was that, in theory, this is a correct way to describe a bonding mechanism. However, they said the reality of the bond market is that nobody would buy these bonds. They're too high risk. They just wouldn't be likely to find any takers.
Senator Monroe.
So with the amendments, are these like double-barreled bonds? I mean, they'd be repaid, backed up by lottery money. They'd be revenue bonds first, but if the revenue was not sufficient to repay the bonds, then they could dip into the lottery. Is that the way it works?
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, that's one way it could work. If there are lottery bonds funding available, that's one way it could work. It depends on which folks we partner with, the condition of the lands, what we could generate immediately versus what might take longer, if it would take longer to rehabilitate those lands and realize some net revenues. My understanding, I don't have a lot of experience on the lottery bonding piece, but my understanding is that there is a method where you can take a more long-term approach towards paying those bonds off as opposed to the traditional bonds where you immediately need to be paying back on those and that you'd have to generate that sufficient revenue to do that. Mm-hmm. But again, that's about the extent of my knowledge. I'm probably further in that than I should be talking about them. But we have met with all the agencies listed in this bill and asked for their feedback, and they have all agreed that and are supportive of the language and the way it's described, the relationship that's described there, and how we would work together to develop a working forest program.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony this morning. And you in here you have a lot of figures, especially in the second major paragraph. Would it be possible for you to give me a map that outlines the state of Oregon and kind of where all this forest land is and what's publicly owned, what's privately owned, what's inside urban growth boundaries and what's not?
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, I'd be glad to do that. We do have those types of maps available, and I can provide that to you.
That would be terrific. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Matt, did you have another question?
Just want to talk to Senator Monroe's question. Senator Monroe, I don't think there is a bonding process in the dash two itself, so it doesn't say you go bond and pay them out of the, but utilize what is the economic development fund would be. And I think the bill is moving from bond and buy and support higher education fund to support higher education fund primarily. So you will establish a higher education fund that comes out of the revenues, the long-term revenues that are coming out of those new acquired forests, and you pay. But the mechanism of how you accumulate that is probably no longer dependent on self-supporting type of mechanism.
But there has to be a substantial amount of capital to make these purchases.
So and that is probably open for future legislatures how to borrow or through appropriation processes how you acquire those lands. At least that's the outlook of the -2 amendments.
Okay.
And the original bill was an interesting concept, but not necessarily classical.
There's -3 amendments too. Do they do it differently?
We're going to hear it.
Yeah. We're going to hear about that next. Okay.
Mr. Clay.
Thank you, Chair Deckard. Committee for the record, bill for the Carpenters Industrial Council. Senator George, you asked a question about the Federal Forest Advisory Committee. I am part of that, and I will be touching bases with everybody as ongoing. Right, what we are doing now, we're just building a strong foundation of arguments to where when we do sit down with our governor, congressional leaders, and our forest managers, hopefully we can move forward on a completely different plan than what we're going through now. But as far as this Bill 98, our memberships are in complete favor of this. It's a good tool. It has to be run correctly to be an asset for this state and not a liability. We have to maximize the sustainable yield off these forests, and that keeps our economy going by keeping my memberships working, our mills running. And I'll try and answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Clayton or the department?
No, I follow up to the question for the department. You mentioned in your testimony about 1 million acres of Oregon's forest exist inside urban growth boundaries. So, you know, when the powers that be after Senate Bill 100 passed in the 70s drew the lines around population centers, several of those lines included lots of forests. Is it the Department of Forestry's intention to purchase forest land that's inside urban growth boundaries?
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, I would state it is our intention is to have a sort of deliberate and strategic look on forest lands in Oregon overall, look at the different communities to the extent that they currently do depend on certain tracts of forest lands within or outside of urban growth boundaries. And I would say not necessarily that this bill isn't about arguing that development is good or bad. It's about saying we should be doing it in a planful way if we can, knowing that development will occur. I think that the fact that we pointed out that 1 million acres will be converted is simply to note that forest lands, regardless of how they're managed or their condition, do provide a lot of values. And if we are, in fact, going to be losing most or all of those, it perhaps makes it even more critical that as we look outside beyond those urban growth boundaries and how development occurs in the future and elsewhere, we're mindful of that and to the extent that we can retain forest lands and forest cover and all of the contributions it makes, both economically but socially, environmentally, that we're able to do that. And this is just one tool, a small tool, but we think an important tool to help with that overall approach.
So the answer is yes.
The answer is maybe. But the extent that it simply doesn't make sense, that it's not viable, say the value of those properties are just are too much, the real estate value is too high, that it's not possible to pull together the capital to maintain those in forest lands, that it would not be a viable place to spend energy and effort in.
Mr. Chair, I think that this bill demonstrates the problems of drawing lines on maps. When we drew the urban growth boundary, at least in my district, around Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and when that built boundary was drawn, we drew in some of the most valuable agriculture land that is anywhere in Oregon. And that's where development's gone, and it's paved over and housed over the best farmland in the Tualatin River Valley. That's a statement, not a question. That's a reality. You know, when we drew lines on map, we drew lines that included, you know, forest land as well. And, you know, we try to control growth to inside these boundaries. In the process, we have potentially eliminated really high-value farm and forest land.
Are there any thoughts or questions? Thank you, Bill. Stephen Cafori, Dave Moskowitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Here again representing the same two clients. Again, the Wildlife Society would be in favor of preserving forests because it preserves critters. I wanted to talk about the issue
of...
Oh, I'm sorry, Stephen Cafori. That's the first time this session, Mr. Chair.
And how many times have you testified?
I don't want to think about it. Regarding the Trust for Public Land, I wanted to just talk briefly about potentials for financing this Senate Bill 98. So I said we're doing a project in Senator George's district right now, 1,400 acres of, this may be a small piece of 1 million, but it's a significant parcel, and I think what we're doing there is important. 1,400 acres of forest land, which we intend to keep as a permanent working forest. Bonneville Power Administration is paying a large chunk. They have hundreds of millions of dollars they spend every year on the fact that they're killing so many salmon by their dams, and this is a way to try and compensate for that. There's lots of dollars. There's money from state parks. There's money from OWEB. There's money from local sources. If you take a look at what's happened in Senator Monroe's district, Senator Burdick's district, and Senator Starr's district, we've the citizens of those areas have bonded themselves, general obligation bonds to pay for purchase of open space and parkland, and some of this money could go for purchase of lands like this. We are also, Treasury Public Land is doing the same kind of local obligation bonding around the state and other localities where people have the feeling that they want to, as a community resource, protect lands. I think that there are lots of sources of money if you don't have to go to one single source to provide the whole purchase price for a piece of property, but do as we do, and that is to gather money from various sources and put a package together. There is economic development money potentially, as you heard said, and if we keep Valley Major 66 going, where 15% of the money from the lottery goes into parks and salmon lands, protection lands, there can be financing this, not to do $1 million, a million acres, but to do some significant purchases. So we think that the bill is very much worthy of passage, and we would hope that you do that.
Thank you.
One other last comment, and that is I am appearing here not just on the same dais with Mr. Moskowitz. We are not together in this, but I did want to say that I've been talking with some of the environmental groups, and I think that there are ways that this bill could be tweaked without changing the fundamental purpose and fundamental goal of the bill that would buy off opposition from the environmental groups, and so that we could have everybody going hand in hand, everyone in this legislature agreeing that this is a bill that we could all support. And I would hope that the this committee would be amenable to some minor tweaks in language that would not change the fundamental purpose of the bill, and that is to produce revenue from cutting trees for higher education. Thank you.
Mr. Moskowitz.
Hello, my name is David Moskowitz, here today on behalf of Wild Salmon Center. Jerry Deckert, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. This bill, Senate Bill 98, is a good bill. It's a good tool. It's important for Oregon to confront the changes that are facing the timber industry in terms of loss of forest land in the active forest as this bill says, timber shed. However, there's a couple of issues about the management of this bill that we want to highlight, and we did draft the Dash 3 amendments, and I'm hoping you have a complete copy in front of you.
We're getting complete.
Okay.
There are. That copy is a complete copy.
I think I handed out copies earlier. I only had one copy, and they had some of my own marks on them. And I think your committee administrator may have, perhaps. I'm not sure if they handed them out, but yeah, those are the ones. My notes are in the back from the last Senate hearing.
I think but if you have,
yeah, there's nothing too dramatically secret
eggs
there.
Buy and milk when I get home.
So yeah, buy milk. That's right. Well, I'm glad I'm doing double duty here. If you'll turn to page 2, one of the key things that we'd like to see change, and these are some of the changes that we think are important, but section 3 is the definition of working forest, and we supplied a slightly different definition than are in the Dash 2 amendments. The key issue here, we are talking about private forest land that's managed currently under the Forest Practices Act, and those lands are managed, you know, individual private and industrial landowners manage those for a whole host of reasons, either for shareholders or for family needs. I'm not here to speak on their behalf by any means. But we believe that all forests are working forests. When trees are standing in a forest, they're helping store carbon, they're helping clean the water, they're providing wildlife habitat for public resources such as fish and wildlife. So every forest is a working forest, we believe. Private forests are typically primarily used to generate revenue for the interest of either the industry or the family. If the state is going to become the owner of those lands, we believe it has a higher duty to manage all of the public resources that come from those lands. And that's why we have issues with the definition in the current bill or in the Dash 2s. And also in Section 4 on the very next page, you'll see a small bracket. And that is the standard for which we'd like to see these forests managed. And we just think it should be managed under the state's state forest management standards that you'd find on the Tillamook and the Clatsop, the Sandy Am, the Elliott. The state manages hundreds of thousands of acres, cuts those acres. The current harvest rate on the Tillamook and Clatsop is 184 million board feet in 2007. And we support that amount. It's probably going to go higher under the plan, but those are generating real revenues for the counties and for the state. We think that if the state is able to generate revenues that allows it to buy lands that are at risk of conversion to non-forest uses, we support that. We just hope that there'll be the forests themselves will be managed at a level that protects those other public values, those other aspects of the working forest. So we have a few changes there in Section 3, and then in Section 4, Sub 3, where the bracket is. And the very last aspect that's important to us are the priorities for acquisition. And if you turn to page 4, and you'll see the primary priorities is circled, and then there's some scribbled numbers there. And this order, A, B, C, and D, under Sub 3, is a reorder from the Dash 2s. The Dash 2s have Sub D, the federal lands, as the first priority for acquisition. We'd like to see the state target the private lands, and that's why we've worded them in that way. There's a number of groups. There's a number of groups. That was the order for milk and eggs, probably. There's a number of organizations that Stephen Ford referred to that they're a little nervous about the federal lands aspect of this, the fact that there's a state bill that's going to ask the state forestry to look at acquiring federal lands. That makes a lot of groups nervous. And I don't really want to get into that issue, but I think that is one reason it's the last of the four priorities. But those are the main changes that are here, and I think that your professional staff commented that the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s almost changed the bill, the original bill, and I think that's true. We do believe that you could take the important bonding elements from the Dash 2s and combine them with some of the policy elements of the Dash 3s, and you would have a good bill. And that's what we would like to see happen. We'd like to support this, and I appreciate the time. I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Great. Questions for Ms. Moskowitz, Mr. Kapoor? Generally, we try to stay out of policy. We do the revenue. Did this discussion occur in the policy committee that had this bill prior? And
It did. This bill had two policy hearings. Senator Deckert and members of the committee, Dave Moskowitz again. The bill was heard very early in January. It was right at that time that the problems on the bonding side were discovered. And so there was a little bit of testimony from some groups concerned about the policy, but it didn't get a full airing. It took a while to come back around, and I was probably partially at fault for how delayed it was in return to the committee. But there was a hearing in the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and these issues were raised. Unfortunately, the Dash 3s had just come out, I think, that day. It was right at the deadline. And so the committee felt there wasn't time. And I think you may want to ask Mr. Paul about his version of what happened. But I think the committee wanted, there was enough support that there was an element of something good there. They wanted to move it on. And there was there were comments from Senator Avakian to urging consideration of these amendments in future hearings. So he passed the ball.
They did the revenue and bonding, and we're looking at the policy considerations. Other questions for Senator Munro?
Yeah, Dave Moskowitz and I worked together when I was on the Metro Council, and he was on staff there. And at that time, there were some members of the council that couldn't say Moskowitz, so they just called him Fish Guy.
Mr. Kapoor and the Fish Guy. Thank you very much. We did get, so we do have now your amendments, Dave, and the official ones. Mr. Charles and Mr. Lindstrom. And John, I couldn't stay up till 11 o'clock last night. You were on the news, I believe, but I just couldn't keep my eyes open to see it.
I have that effect on people sometimes. Don't know what I was on TV for, but I'm to the bill, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, and I would like to bring up revenue issues with you in a sort of a contrarian fashion, for which I sometimes do, which is to suggest that if your goal is to raise money for schools, this is a highly risky way to do it, and we don't need to speculate much about that because we have a very long track record of observing this very method through the common school trust lands that were deeded to the state in 1859. Now, I published a paper recently about the last part of those trust lands that is the most highest valued part still left. 98% of them were sold off over the years to provide for capital and operations for schools. And the Elliott State Forest is still in state hands. And it's interesting that in the page 1 of Senate Bill 98, which is still to remain, even with your dashes, it talks about, down in lines 19, whereas the state's experience with the Elliott, Tillamook, etc. shows the state-owned forest lands are a good investment that both maintains working forests and produces funding for schools. I would say the history is the exact opposite of that. And in fact, when the DSL produced their first asset management plan in 1995, they said flat out in it that for the last 20 years, the performance of our real estate portfolio relative to the equities and stocks in the Common School Fund managed by the Oregon Investment Council, the real estate has been underperforming the market for the last 20 years at least, because raising revenue has really never been a primary goal within the department. Well, 10 years later, they've produced their next asset management plan. The same problem continues. We have essentially a 30-year track record in which, even though the Oregon Constitution mandates that the primary objective of these common school trust lands is to raise income over the long term for schools, other priorities have taken over so that raising revenue is no longer the primary goal. Now, and in fact, that's why back in 1994, the late John Buter, a very highly acknowledged forest economist, did a study for Department of Forestry, and I have a copy right here, in which He said flat out, after analyzing eight or nine scenarios, he said the best way to maximize revenue for the Common School Fund in terms of the Elliott is to sell it. It was worth about $1 billion then. And if they had done that, the Common School Fund today is worth about $1.1 billion. The way it has appreciated over the last 12 years, if they had done what Mr. Buter suggested, put the money into the stocks and bonds and other investments, the Common School Fund today would be worth certainly over $3 billion. That is a lot of money to be leaving on the table. Now, why are we doing what we're doing, which is not only hanging on to the Elliott, DSL itself now wants to do what this bill does. They want to acquire more lands. But when you get those lands, what happens is the very issues Mr. Moskowitz raises take over. Right away, you have the definition of a working forest kind of changes, and maximum revenue kind of slides away. And pretty soon, as with the Elliott, and you can see here in the paper I wrote on page 2, issues of management costs, there's a chart here, management costs as a percent of total revenue has been skyrocketing. This was predicted in 1995, and the asset management plan has gotten worse, largely because of Endangered Species Act issues. So the revenue doesn't go up much, but the management goes up.
Is now, the management, the, John, the total cost percentage of revenue, that's your management costs?
Yes, you have personnel service costs specifically, and then total management costs. And you can see that those have been rising steadily. In fact, for the next biennium, it's projected that management costs will eat up 50% of the total harvest, primarily because of the way DOF and DSL choose to implement the Endangered Species Act, which is a very burdensome and expensive way that private landowners don't choose to do. Now, recently, if you turn to pages 5 and 6 of my paper, recently, Department of Forestry, in conjunction with Dr. John Sessions of OSU and the Douglas Timber Operators, did a series of model runs looking at the way the Elliott could be managed if it were in private hands. And you can see that under any, by any criteria, harvest volume, annual net revenues, or there's three graphs on page 6 dealing with return on asset value, under state ownership, return on asset value is going to shrink, and they're leaving huge amounts of volume out there. Why? Because even though the state constitution mandates maximum revenue, that's not the way the forest is treated, precisely because it's publicly owned. And you need to understand, public lands are political lands. And political lands have, everyone then has a stake in managing them, and the default is to not cut many trees. And I point out, maybe perhaps the last thing I'll point here, figure 7 on page 8, is a chart, net forest growth in Western Oregon. And you can see that in terms of raising revenue, it's the private landowners on a sustainable harvest basis who are raising the revenue. They're still leaving 16% of natural growth, so that it's sustainably harvested, only 2% mortality, and they harvest 81% of growth. Well, in the federal lands, you know, those have become basically museums or biomass fuel depots waiting for the next catastrophic fire. And then the state lands, it's a little better, but you still see large amounts of mortality, relatively small amounts of harvest, huge amounts of surplus. So again, the point of the bill, as I understand it, primarily is to create sort of an endowment for higher ed. But if that's the case, this is unlikely to actually raise much revenue, because the Elliott State Forest, which has had a constitutional mandate to do that, is not doing it. And they should have sold it a long time ago, and the Common School Fund today would be worth a lot more. And my final point on that, I guess, is on the dash twos, page 3, something you haven't talked about yet, lines 18 through 24, says the
DSL. Can you see the dash twos?
Your dash twos, page 3.
Lines 18.
Say section 5, sub 3. DSL may use monies in the Common School Fund for the acquisition and operation of a working forest. Well, first of all, I view that as unconstitutional. The only purpose of the Common School Fund by Constitution is to raise money for common schools, not to be some bank to be loaning stuff out. And second, the payback is return to CSF, line 21, in an amount proportionate to the amount invested in the working forest. But that's not the appropriate metric. The appropriate metric is what was the opportunity cost of the money you took out of CSF, which was earning, doing a lot of a high interest earning in under the management of the Oregon Investment Council. When you pay back proportionate to some other investment of trees, it will never be paid back at the appropriate rate. And just so you know, I point out here, reference my paper again, page 7 of my paper, you look at PERS as an example I put in here. And you had a report last week, I think, showing that PERS earned 15% last year. Well, over the last 5 years, the PERS fund for the real estate investments, 5-year annualized average returns, 18% per year. And in their real estate investment trust, REITs, 5-year annualized 26%. My gosh, I wish they could manage my money. I mean, there is no scenario under Senate Bill 98 of going to the trouble of buying timberlands, this long-term management thing, inviting all the stakeholders in, all the environmental groups, talking about what is working for us mean. You're not going to get these kind of returns. If you have any extra money lying around under your cushions here, give it to the Oregon Investment Council and manage it as an endowment. And actually, I thought, last time I looked at the Treasury report, I thought you already have a higher ed endowment anyway that sort of does this. But if not, there is almost no branch of state government that is going to give you the kind of return that the Oregon Investment Council does for the Common School Fund, PERS, and all of their other accounts. They do a great, great job. So I just think this is fraught with risks because public lands are political lands, and that if your goal is to help higher ed by taking some pot of money and growing it, this is the last thing I would do with my own grandchildren's money if I wanted to, you know, have a long-term investment for them. It's way too risky. I would put it into stocks, bonds, and REITs, let the Oregon Investment Council do what they do best, and just sit back every year and have them give the report that, well, we earned another 12%, another 15%, no EISs, no community meetings about which lands we're going to buy, all these issues. It's just fraught with many, many landmines that I think you really need to be thoughtful of before you go down that road.
Very compelling testimony. Thank you, John. Senator George.
John, it's amazing that you presented this because I've had those same ideas going through my head. 15.3 return, what are we going to get on this? And the very fact that this one chart that shows the comparison between the private and the two publics is just extremely revealing. That's if you want health and healthy forests, you're only going to choose one route.
I agree, Senator.
Other questions for Mr. Charles? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Lindstrom, if you're here, you're signed up, but I'll make sure I'm pronouncing your name. Dan Charles Lindstrom. Must have left. Okay, that concludes our testimony on Senate Bill 98, close the public hearing. Tomorrow we have the forecast at 8:45, so we'll be joined by the House and get the most important forecast we get, the May forecast tomorrow at 8:45. We are adjourned until tomorrow at 8:45.